Welcome to Street Hypnosis. This is session 2 of the masterclass entitled Discover the Hypnotic Profiling Secrets that let you read people like an open book anytime, anywhere, and with anyone. So in session 1, you already discovered a very simple way of starting to read people and categorize them into one of 4 basic groups: earth, fire, air, and water. And we did make an emphasis at the time to remember that if you find someone's, shall we say, personality or someone's profile, they're not necessarily the way that they're presented. In other words, as the context change, they will change. And also, more importantly, as their state changes, they will start changing. So the kind of change that we're looking for is here: the context will influence the state will influence the thinking style, the thinking style will end up influencing the language and behavior, and based on the language and behavior, we can actually come up with a simple profile to understand how these people are thinking, feeling, acting, and so on, and of course, how to influence them. Now, as useful as that simple test is, abstraction versus concrete thinking and right brain versus left brain thinking, you come up with 4 basic types of people, which can tell you a lot about people and it can be very useful in terms of how you interact with the people around you. But let's face it, it's a bit of a crude model. No matter how elegant it is in terms of, you know, how accurate it is in terms of the things you can describe of people and stuff like that, when you actually take a look at the world outside, you can see millions upon millions upon millions of people, and no two are exactly alike. So just because you can categorize them into one of 4 categories, well, they're not robots. There's not just 4 people in the world, and they just happen to have different faces over and over again. We're talking about tendencies here. Some will have stronger tendencies in one way, some have softer than others. So there's going to be variations going on within the themes. So you can have those main themes, just simple ways of you to understand people. And then how do you start getting to the more sophisticated way of looking at people so that those themes in their variations begin to build more, if you like, accurate pictures of how people are, how people think, how people feel, and so on. Well, this is what I call the profile modifiers. When you think about it, we had 2 simple questions that we asked, which has already given us a lot of information, 4 basic character types, and allowed us to make a lot of assumptions, a lot of educated guesses about how a person will respond in that given context. So what would happen if, instead of just having 2 of these questions, you know, abstract versus concrete, right brain versus left brain, and so on, what if we start adding more questions, each one looking for more refined kinds of things? You see, at that point what happens is you end up turning your 4 personalities into 8, your 8 into 16, 32, and so on, and those personality types, those profiles, start multiplying. And the multiplication keeps on continuing exponentially, as long as you keep being able to add new variants and useful variants. So what we want to do today is focus on some of those useful variations, some of those things which will give you a much richer profile, a richer understanding of how each of the 4 characters, for the 4 profiles, can be modified to become a little bit more accurate and give you different kinds of information. Now, before we launch into that whole thing, I'd like to make a point, which is that the 4 profiles, whilst they aren't necessarily, you know, the end all be all, it's going to be people who've got variations and differences and so on, there is a tendency for one profile, like for example earth or fire or water, to collect certain types of characteristics. Now, it doesn't mean that all people who are earth people, all people who are fire people, etc., will always be the same way. But it does mean that most people that are earthy, for example, will tend to want to follow the rules. Now, there could be quite a number of rule breakers among the earth-type population, and that's fine. As long as you're aware of it, you now get to draw a much finer distinction within the character. And if you're not aware of it, you can carry on with the educated guess that chances are that these people will actually be following the rules and like a nice steady progression and that sort of stuff. So what we're doing here is we're allowing us to fine-tune each individual character profile in a way that will allow you to actually make more accurate pictures of the people that you meet and interact with on a day-to-day basis. We'll also be talking a little bit about which of these characteristics actually fit within a particular element more. In other words, people who are in the air element will tend towards having certain things in terms of intellectualization, in terms of being independent thinkers and not needing feedback too much, and these sort of things. Once you know what those are, you can look out for them. And when those things aren't the way you expect them to be, because that's the tendency, the pattern that you would expect, well, then you'll know why it's not working that way. And again, you'll have that more refined picture. So either way, you end up winning. Finally, we're going to go into relatively complex or sophisticated ideas and using more polar opposites to create these refined pictures. And I don't want you to think that you have to be using all of these things all of the time. Why? Well, because whilst you can create a very sophisticated picture of people, sometimes all that you need is a snapshot. In fact, I'd say that most things that people need, whether it's social, work, or otherwise, a snapshot can be more useful than too accurate a picture. And that's purely and simply because it requires less processing power from you. You have to sit there and analyze less. You have to make less choices about things. You can get on with the interaction more and let those basic elemental pictures that you have, that snapshot, guide your actions and take you from place to place. And if that snapshot isn't enough, if for some reason things aren't working out the way you want them to, well, then you'll have the ability to refine the snapshot and actually get the kind of information that you will need in order to make the satisfactory changes and get a better kind of relationship with that person in question. But my general rule of thumb is that whenever I talk to people, whenever I start using the four elements, I don't really go much beyond those unless something happens which is a bit weird or quirky. It's like, why is this person acting this way? I don't understand. It doesn't really fit the picture or the snapshot that I have of them. Only then, when I need it, will I go into my tool bag and start pulling out these other questions, these other polls that we'll be focusing on today. Because then it makes sense. Then it actually becomes a useful process. I'm a big believer in keeping things simple, streamlined, elegant, and smooth. And it's up to you whether you do the same thing. Some of you will actually end up using these polar opposites to such an extent that they become second nature to you. So it's easy for you to make 32, 64, or 128 distinctions very quickly. Whereas others will just go, let's just stick with the four basic elements and let the rest take care of itself. Now, another thing that we need to talk about, especially when it comes to these other kind of questions, is something we talked about before, which is, you know, in different contexts, in different states, under pressure, no pressure, when they really want something, when they don't really want something, high motivation, low motivation, and so on, you can get a change in their profile. So then the question is, how do you get a stable profile? How can you make sure the profile that you're getting is useful? Well, one of the ways to do it, of course, is that you're asking the questions or you're interacting with them live in the context that you need to be using this stuff in, which means the context which will already have set the conditions you want to have in order to get the correct profile out of the people. However, sometimes it becomes very useful to know or be able to predict how people will act or fit in a different context or under a different set of circumstances, for example, when the pressure gets turned up. So how do you test people to find out what the profile will be and how the profile will change under these alternative conditions? I'd like to run you through a quick method or a couple of ideas of the kind of things that I would do in a normal interaction. I used to do this when I was coaching, particularly when I was coaching other people to do a better sales process or bid or presentation. So they would have to use some of the profiling tools that we've been talking about here, sometimes without really knowing about it, sometimes they report back, and sometimes we'd actually train them in how to use the profiles a bit better. But in any event, these are a couple of little things you can do with people in order to get a better quality of information out of them. The first thing we like to do is to put the pressure on them. Now, when I say put the pressure on them, I don't mean get the thumb screwed out, get the lantern, shine it in the face, and ask them where they were at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's kind of a bit of a cliche. However, the idea behind those kind of maneuvers is actually very fitting in what we're doing. In fact, the whole field of forensic investigation, asking questions of witnesses, particularly people who are hesitant or resistant, there's a whole psychology built into that, which is a very fascinating thing to go through. You don't need that level of interaction to be able to get more accurate profiles. As a rule, when I talk about pressure, what I mean is to see how they handle different kinds of information. On one level, for example, You can start making some outrageous statements, outrageous claims, tell outrageous stories, something that's outside of the norm in that context, to see how they react at the extremes. Making a very dull comment, making a very outrageous comment, and notice what the reaction is. Do they snap up the duller one more? Do they snap up the outrageous one more? Do they resist? Do they fight back? Do they collapse? Do they retreat? What are the responses? Secondly, I like to tease them. When you tease people, and you can do this in a very friendly way, again, you're putting some pressure on them. You're putting social pressure on them, which tends to let some of the more, shall we say, controlled elements, the bits where they're trying to present a good face to the world, they'll forget themselves long enough that they'll start acting or behaving or speaking in a way that's, quote unquote, more natural to them. And that's the kind of side that we're looking for, the more unconscious responses. There's other ways to get there as well, but teasing can be very useful. Of course, you want to make sure you do this in a manner that's respectful, just so that you don't end up traumatizing everyone around you. Otherwise, you might end up running out of friends. The next thing you can do is, again, to do with pressure, is to put the spotlight on them. Teasing, in some respects, put the spotlight on them because their minds are trying to keep racing to keep up with what you're doing, what you're saying, and so on. But another way to do it is just usually to use the social pressure by getting the whole group to pay attention to them. Just getting the whole group to refocus attention on the person. For example, you can start talking to the group and say, well, so-and-so over here did this. Why don't you tell us about this thing that you did the other day? Or, you know, I usually find that when I work in this particular kind of environment doing these sort of things, this is the kind of reaction I have. Tell us, in other words, not tell me, but tell us, you know, all four or five of us here, how do you do it? And now that person is under pressure because all the eyes, all the attention are on them. And you'll see how they react. Now, why might you want to do this? In a moment, for example, when we come on to the idea of extroversion and introversion, this is a great test for extroversion and introversion. The extrovert will love the attention. They'll enjoy the social pressure, and they'll bloom or blossom under it. The introvert, on the other hand, will try to evade the social pressure, will try and avoid too much attention, and find a way, usually quite an elegant way, of bowing out or redirecting the pressure or the attention somewhere else, and sometimes just by shutting the whole questioning line down because they really aren't comfortable with that kind of pressure. The final kind of maneuver I like to use in terms of applying pressure is to start challenging people. And I mean challenging people and saying, you know, you're nuts or you're evil, you're bad, or let's have a fight. I'm talking about more to disagree with a point of view. They express something, an idea or a statement, and whether or not I agree with it is irrelevant. I might just start challenging it, either the logic behind it or the reasoning behind it or just to the general position in any event, just to see how they react. And we see how they react to the challenge. Again, you get in a sense of what kind of people they are. Later on, we'll be talking a bit, for example, about the masculine and feminine energies. Some thrive on challenge, take the bait and go, great, now we're going to have a nice tussle. Others collapse under a challenge and try and retreat away from it. Maybe even in an extreme sense might get a little hurt that you might even have questioned them or questioned their integrity. Again, these, especially when it comes to pressure, these are ploys which have to be done sensitively. You have to use a bit of social know-how to apply these things, because if you start doing them the wrong way, you end up losing friends, you start insulting people, you start hurting people, and that's not really the point of what we're doing here. What we want to be doing here is to find out more about how people tick. So doing this with a playful air, a charming air, an air that, you know, people will want to be engaged in the process. And at that point, you'll get a much clearer snapshot of who people are and how they think and behave. At the same time, you're not necessarily burning your bridges and becoming a social pariah. Now, for those of you who aren't comfortable with the idea of pressure, the other things you can do are, for example, to use psychological projection. Essentially, people don't see the world as it is, they see the world as they are. And we can make use of this by putting people into a situation or asking people about another event, a random event, and seeing what the responses are. Now, those people will think that they're commenting on an event outside of themselves. But in the way that they comment about it, they're going to be revealing their own attitudes, their own beliefs, their own way of seeing the world, etc., because that's just part of naturally how they see the whole situation. So how do you use this? Well, one example might be to use the My Friend John technique. And you sit around and say, you know, my friend John needs advice. He's got this situation. These things are happening to him. Why do you think these people are treating him this way? Why do you think that this is happening to him? And the context of the situation that your friend John ends up finding himself in is, of course, something which is loaded for you to find out something about the person that you're facing. For example, introversion, extroversion, are they motivated by pleasure or pain, and so on. The other way that you can do this is something that we did in the Mind Game Magic deck of cards, and you can literally repackage this whole My Friend John technique into a little psychological game, these kind of profiling games, which I've done a couple of these. I think on the Magic Moments Masterclass, there are two of these psychological profiles as well. And of course, in the Mind Game Magic deck, I think there's a half dozen or so. And essentially, what you do is you do the same thing as My Friend John technique, but now you turn them into an official little party game by creating these fun little situations. For example, you know, you're the captain of the Titanic, it's going down, and you know, everyone's panicking on board, etc. How do you deal with things? Are you gonna just get the women and children life rafts and start launching straight away? Are you gonna get the manual out and see what it says about how to handle emergency situations? Or you're gonna collect people together and start asking, you know, calming them down, saying, we'll get through this if we all pull together. Now notice, especially later on, when we start dealing with these polarities more in today's session, that essentially I've given them a kind of a fun scenario. The whole Titanic thing is kind of romantic and people can get involved in the story. But by giving this little multiple choice test at the end, seeing how they react and making it fun at the same time, it allows people to project into the situation and give you information about how they would handle it had they been there themselves. Now, this is no perfect test. This is not 100%. Sometimes it'll miss. Sometimes people will tell you what they think you want to hear rather than how they would react. Sometimes they can't think themselves into the situation properly. For example, you know, the Titanic test there is a little bit about how people respond under pressure. And if they don't feel the pressure, they might not be able to think themselves into that kind of situation unless you help them out with hypnotics. So these things are by no means perfect, but they are definitely worthwhile and useful, and another little feather you can put in your cap to make the process more robust. Another thing you can do in terms of using the idea of perception as projection is to get people to do some armchair quarterbacking. People love to do this anyway. They say this, they do it all the time. They'll complain about their leaders, they'll complain about their bosses, they'll complain about other people saying, well, I think that decision was bad. If I was the boss, I'd do it this way. If I was a boss, I'd say these things, or move this thing over here, or change this thing over here. Essentially, what they're doing there is they project themselves into the same situation. So rather than being in My Friend John technique, they're using a real situation, a real context, which matches the kind of context you want to know about. And at that point, the way they would end up solving the problem, the way they would react in that situation, tells you, well, basically what the polarities are. And the questions to do that are very simple, you know. What do you think of so-and-so's policy? What do you think of when so-and-so did this? How do you feel about that? It sounds like an innocent question, like a normal social, small talk, social interaction sort of question. And actually, it really is. And people are using these kind of questions unconsciously all the time in order to get a sense of who they're talking to and, you know, doing a kind of an unconscious profile. So we're always doing these any things anyway. We're just talking about how to refine that process and do it a bit more on purpose so you actually get the information you want when you need it and when you want it. Let's move on to another technique, which we touched on a little bit under the pressure heading. And that's the idea of using distractions. Remember, we're looking to get genuine, unconscious responses. Those are the best things we can get. Now, sometimes, for whatever reason, the situation, like in an interview, has warped the social dynamic. So people are too self-conscious in order to act spontaneously, act naturally, act unconsciously. So you have to basically redress the balance at that point by creating a context in which they forget themselves long enough for the kind of or the quality of answer that you need to come out to emerge. How do we do this? Well, there are basically two things. One is to just catch natural reactions as they occur. So you give people longer tasks, things where their minds get involved in something. For example, if you're doing an interview series, you can get three or four interviewees to do a task like arrange a banquet or get some information and put it into a certain table or just work some kind of problem through. It really doesn't matter what it is. Then you sit back and you observe how they're interacting. Now, they think they're going to be judged on how well they do the task, how well they succeed at refining the, getting the project right. But at the same time, you get to actually see or test for their genuine reactions. How are they with other people? How are they working with them? What's going on as they're doing it? Are they more focused on getting the task done? Are they more focused on creating harmony between the other participants? Are they more focused on following the rules that are being set down for them? What are they doing? When that happens, they're so involved in what they think the task is that you actually get a much higher quality information out of them. The other way to do this is to use surprise. The beauty about surprise is no one can plan their response to it because they don't know it's going to come. It's unexpected. So when you start throwing in unexpected things, unexpected curveballs, quick comments, a random question, and really bring a little bit of pressure on getting the answer, at that point, people can't do anything but rely on their unconscious mind because that's the one that comes up with the answers quickly, and you end up getting a much cleaner response, a much more accurate response in terms of what you want. Now, surprise doesn't always work because people will sometimes artificially inflate the timeline to get more time to actually think about what they're going to say and so on. So there's also kind of interview tricks like, you know, repeating the questions, thinking about it, taking time to mull it over, all that sort of stuff. Those are tricks that people can use to overcome the element of surprise. However, it's still a very valuable tool that you can have in your toolbox and use the right timing and present it in the right sort of way. It can get a very, very high quality of information out. Finally, we'll have something charming which doesn't fit every context, but in some contexts, for example, social contexts at parties, dating, with friends, with people that you're getting more, shall we say, personally connected with, this can be a very fun game to play or a fun thing to do, and you'll still get a lot of valuable information out. It's essentially called the questions game, or 20 questions. And I mean 20 questions in the sense of you think of something and I have to try and guess what it is. The questions game is very simple. You're going to give people a simple set of binary choices. Now, most of those choices are frivolous, irrelevant, unimportant, just kind of fun things like, you know, do you prefer fruit or salad? Do you like cars or bikes? But from time to time, you're going to throw in certain questions, certain polarity questions, which are designed to actually get you the answer to a certain kind of things. For example, would you think it's worse to have your head stuck in the clouds or to be stuck in a rut? Now think about what I'm doing there. What kind of information am I asking for? Well, I'm asking them if they prefer abstract thinking or concrete thinking. If it's worse to have your head in the clouds, that means they're a concrete thinker. They like real things they can hang on to. If they think it's worse to be stuck in a rut than to be an abstract thinker, it's okay to have your heads up in the clouds somewhere. So, in other words, thinking abstractly, as long as you don't get stuck or bogged down in details. So you can always reword the concepts behind all the different polarities, the ones that we'll be discussing today and the ones that we, of course, discussed in the last session. You can always reword those and rework them in such a way that you can fit them into the questions game and, again, get a very high quality information out. The reason you want to not just throw those questions out on their own is, again, going back to the idea of distraction. If all you're doing is asking questions like, you know, do you find it harder to make a critical judgment or a value judgment? You prefer to be practical or inspired? You know, if you start asking these questions, after a while people start cottoning on that there's a theme here, there's a pattern, and they might start interfering with the pattern, they might start trying to answer how they think they should be answering and so on. If you, on the other hand, make this like a fun game, a game which is just the answers are throwaway. Who cares if you prefer fruit or salad? Who cares whether you prefer pink or blue? It really doesn't matter. There's no self-esteem issues involved in it. There's no sense of approval or anything like that going on in there. So people are likely to give you a genuine response. Sure, I like fruit. I like salad too, but I prefer fruit if I had the choice. You know, pink, blue, well, I prefer blue if I had the choice. It seems like a frivolous, no-brainer kind of just a fun game to do with them. And as they get into the spirit of that, of course, you can slip in these other questions and they'll be answered in the same natural, no, not thinking too much about it sort of way. And that's exactly what you want, because we're not thinking about it too much. When they're giving you a spontaneous, off the top of their head kind of response, well, guess where that's coming from? Exactly. It's the unconscious mind, which is really the place you want the answer to be coming from. So with those thoughts, I'd like to launch into now what I call the profile modifiers, which will allow you to take the basic four profiles, the fire, water, air, and earth elements, and modify them so you get ever more sophisticated readings of someone's character, of someone's, well, when I say character, of course, I'm not saying who they are as a, you know, that true self, more how they think, how they behave in that kind of context at that point in time. The first of these profile modifiers is extroversion and introversion. Now, we all know about extroversion and introversion. You know, the extroverts are people who are sociable, they're going to go out there, they like meeting people, they feel re-energized when they're around people, they like, you know, parties, at parties they like meeting strangers in and people they don't know and, you know, discovering what's going on inside them and that sort of stuff. Typically, the extroverts will be kind of people who will chat to people on in a bus stop or whilst waiting in a queue somewhere. They'll be in a hurry to get the phone so they can start chatting to people. They have no problems of interacting with strangers. It's a pleasure for them in many ways. Introverted people, of course, on the other hand, are more private. They prefer listening or being observant, noticing things that are going on. They tend to be more reserved and less approachable. It doesn't mean that these people are unsociable, it's just that they have, shall we say, greater difficulties being in a larger group or being the center of attention and so on. Now, if you want to play the questions game with people, what kind of questions can you throw in there to test for extroversion and introversion? Well, you can say, you know, do you prefer to speak or listen? Are you more outgoing or private? Approachable or reserved? You can ask the same question in many different ways to see what the patterns is. For example, they may answer the same question phrased differently in a different way. So if you ask it 5 times, they might give you 3 answers one way, 2 answers the other. And that again gives you a little bit of information that they're more borderline than, you know, the extremes. So how do you do this? Well, extroversion and introversion. You might ask people who, if they prefer to speak or listen, are they more talkative or observant? Do they consider themselves a good conversationalist or a good listener? And notice how we're really asking the same questions over and over again, but they're being rephrased slightly. The trick here is you never ask the same question in a row twice. Why? Well, because people work out what you're doing, and then it really hasn't got the same impact. You want people to not work out what you're doing, so they're giving you a genuine response straight away. So I like to weave these into kind of random questions, like the questions game. Or if you are going to use them, this is how psychologists use them in their psychometric tests. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next session. They basically just weave them in between different questions. So you might test for abstraction and extroversion. Then you might ask another question for, you know, motivation direction. You might ask another question for left brain, right brain. Then go back to a extroversion question, then another right brain question. And so just by mixing all these things together, no one really starts figuring out what the pattern is and what things you're looking for because they don't know what you're looking for. And you tend to get better quality responses. It's by no means perfect because people are smart enough, especially if they have a little bit of understanding of the kind of things that you're doing, to answer the questions in the way they think you want them to answer those questions. This is particularly true if there's something in it for them. So, for example, doing psychometrics for interviews in order to hire people is something I don't really agree with. You can do it and maybe get some quality of information out of it, but I'd still distrust what you get from that paper and pencil test because if the people are smart, they'll figure out what it is you want from them. It's usually in your advertising or your literature about your company. And then they'll make sure that profile matches. It's not really difficult to figure out what the question is designed to try and elicit from you. In any event, let's take this idea then of extroversion and introversion and see if we can do something with it in terms of modifying the characters. So what might be an extroverted earth type character be like? So let's say we've got an Ed or an Edna who's quite extroverted. Well, what would we be like? Well, let's think about it. That's an earth type person is someone who tends to like the rules, the system being followed through, you know, step by step. Also tends to be more sociable as well. So on the one side, you'll have someone who is quite happy to enforce rules. So you might have, on the one hand, like a noisy neighbor coming out saying, hey, you can't put your bins there, it's not allowed, it's the rules say you have to put them in 5 inches behind your back garden wall or something like that. In an office environment, you might have a manager or a foreman who basically is quite happy to tell people around him how to do their jobs and to basically follow the company rules and procedures. This is particularly prevalent in the army, for example, where your sergeant major types, your junior officers are all there, and you know, you can pretty much assume that they're going to be following the rule book to the letter. The upside of an extroverted Earth-type character would be that they tend to be quite ambitious. They tend to aim for executive positions, precisely because they get to have this idea of enforcing rules or creating the rules that other people can follow along with. They're very good at organizing stuff because, again, they've got this very procedural, step-by-step sort of logical minds. And they're very good at communicating those rules because they have such a detail orientation. Perhaps some people might think that they are a little bit too anal, too many rules or too much detail in the rules. But again, you know, there's swings and roundabouts in that. Socially speaking, an extroverted Earth-type character will probably be quite giving. Maybe your classic welfare worker who's really wanting to make a difference. It could be a wealthy philanthropist just doing something to enrich his community or going to do some project in Africa to help, you know, kids who haven't got as many opportunities as other people. Another way you might spot an extroverted Earth-type character is in the archetypical host at a party. The person who makes sure that everyone is enjoying themselves, that, you know, the shy people aren't being left in the corners and talking to themselves, that people are being relaxed, that they're happy, they've got enough food. In other words, really kind of taking care of people. It would be interesting to compare that to, say, an introverted Earth-type character. So let's look at the more rule-bound elements of it. This kind of person might want to indirectly enforce the rules without necessarily telling you to your face. So they might leave a note in your room, or more likely, they'll be kind of feeling comfortable to depersonalize the rule enforcement. So maybe an auditor comes in and presents a report. Here's what's going on. Here are the things we discovered. Here's what we recommend you do. Up to you what you do. In reality, of course, they want people to follow their advice, but it's phrased in such an indirect, sort of gentle sort of way, because they don't want to, they're not as in your face about things as extroverts are. They're more reserved and more held back. So, you know, a surveyor making a report about your house might be this sort of type as well. You can still get the whole nosy neighbor sort of thing, but this nosy neighbor, rather than telling you where to put your bins, would probably call up the local council to say that your bins are in the wrong place and could someone please come around and sort you out. So that's the kind of fundamental difference between what an extroverted or an introverted Earth-type character might look like. In terms of a social setting, on the other hand, again, they'll be a little quieter. That's part of the whole introversion thing. And they'll probably be tending towards wanting to present some kind of service. So they might like to be at a party rather than sort of mingling and chatting to people. They might be the one that grabs a tray of entrees or drinks and helps the host by carrying them around and offering to people. And that's kind of their way of being sociable without having the pressure of having to come up with funny stories or telling them about, you know, what's going on and keeping the conversation alive. Instead of doing that, they can still have that social interaction, but by providing some kind of value, some kind of service by handing out drinks and so on. And these tend to be people who will probably just quietly get on with it. So whilst an extrovert, say in the office, an earthy extrovert, might tell everyone about all the fantastic projects he's doing and how they're progressing and keep everyone up to speed, the introverted Earth-type character is more likely just to quietly get on with it and beaver away until it's all done. And, you know, then just let you know kind of casually that he's finished and everyone's going to go, I didn't know you were working on that yet. So this is kind of the key differences between one element that can be extroverted or introverted. What happens if you go to another element? Let's see if we can add the same kind of polar responses to, say, the fire element. So again, fire people are very sociable, they're very outgoing. They tend towards the more flamboyant interaction with people. So an extroverted fire type would be the classic extrovert who is charming, he's persuasive, particularly, you know, your archetypical salesperson who's got the gift of the gab, who can talk about anything to anyone and really build rapport. You might even have an extroverted fire type person being the entertainer. At a party, the one who sits down at the piano and plays for everyone. It might be an actor or an actress. So people who have that flamboyance, they carry it forward, but it's always with a focus on the experience that people are having. Entertainment is giving people an experience. Someone who's a persuader or charming people is, again, molding the experience someone's having in order to get the result that they want. Now, interestingly enough, if you have an introverted fire character, you get some interesting things coming out of that. Remember, most people think that fire characters, because of their nature being more sociable, being more rooted in the here and now and having fun and enjoying life, they can see them as being very extroverted. But now we have this polar opposite, and people think, well, could fire people really be introverted? Sure they can. It's just interesting quirks that are coming out of it. An introverted fire type person, for example, might be an artist that is passionate about the painting that they do, but is locked away in some small hut in the middle of nowhere because, you know, they don't necessarily get on with people so well or have the connection they can have with people on a day-to-day basis, but they still want to express themselves through a painting, and they still like their paintings going out into the world. In other words, they're making their impact on the world indirectly. So it might be, another one example might be a composer or someone who writes scripts rather than the actor that actually turns those scripts into an actual movie. On another level, an introverted fight-up character might go the other way, and away from necessarily the arts into the more technique-y side things, so playing with gadgets, becoming technically proficient. Again, their impact becomes more indirect. And that's kind of the key thing to see between extroverted and introverted type characters. One is very upfront and everyone can see what they're doing. The other is more indirect in what they're doing. They'll still like social things. They'll still want to have part of that. It's just they don't want to have as much attention, as much energy being directed to them. So they like to have the more kind of the side or the edges of things there. An extroverted air type character might be your classic visionary leader, someone who's great at coordinating people or complex tasks, has a great vision that other people kind of buy into. And, you know, for example, in wars, you might be the great generals who have thousands of troops to move and a strategy to fulfill and all these different things to run at the same time. It might even be someone who is an inventor, again, taking the idea of complexity and putting it together into a sophisticated machine, developing new machines or concepts for something. An internal air type character, again, takes this, that intellectual idea, that's the idea of creating a plan of the future and so on, but it's going to be more indirect about the way that it influences people with it. So that might be a person who's more interested in planning something, creating schedules or a blueprint. For example, an architect that creates a blueprint for the house rather than the person that actually builds it and shows everyone how cool it is. In terms of the water element, again, let's have a look at the two extroversion and introversion poles and how that might reach that person. A water element person, people tend to think of them as more introverted, but then again, it can have effects in both directions. An extroverted water person would probably be someone who enjoys teaching, in other words, fostering people's personal growth, but in groups. So they can really foster group learning, bind a group together, bring them together, get them to learn things, grow from them. It'd be someone who might be an adventurer, who wants to actually have all these experiences in terms of the spiritual quest or in terms of going around the world to find out how other people are doing this self-actualization thing and actually experiencing it. Another type that might be a external or a extroverted water element could be someone who is a kind of a Joan of Arc, who's got a cause and it takes up arms for the cause and lets everyone hear about it, makes a lot of noise, and can create, be a tremendous force for social change. An introverted water type person, on the other hand, would be having the same kind of urges to help people grow and change, etc. That's the whole water feature. But they'd be doing it in a more indirect sort of way, or a more personal sort of level. So instead of being the big group leader, someone who starts maybe an academy or takes up a cause and starts picketing outside political offices to get it heard, their cause heard, an introverted person might instead still take up a cause, but instead of standing out there and shouting about it, collect petitions and send them in, or perhaps write articles about the ideas that other people can then be swayed by. Typically, you might find this in a sort of coaching or therapeutic context, that people really want to be the healers of the world, the ones that take one person, create a nice intimate connection, and through that get to help people make changes. They like the role of arbitrating, partly because it is that much more personal. There's not so many people involved, but it still has that transformational moment. And you might even find them in the role of a mentor, someone who wants to change the world, but indirectly by influencing the next generation and maybe even the key points in the next generation and letting individuals that they've mentored end up going out there and doing the things that they themselves don't have as much of an inclination of doing. So that's the idea of extroversion and introversion. Hopefully you can see just from that, and it's a very simple idea, extroversion and introversion, but you can already see how combining that pole with the ideas of the four elements begins to develop some much more refined characters, some much more interesting characters than just the four elements on their own. It gives you a lot more information about how people are, how they behave and respond, and about their likes and dislikes.